This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And first hour this evening, our guest is going to be Carl Grunwald. We're going to be talking about really what's going on economically in the world today. And you can't, of course, separate economically from politically. You know, a lot of very interesting things are happening, and we try to connect the dots, and sometimes they just don't make sense. For instance, the Democrats recently had a legislation that passed, and they had an amendment on that bill that would have prevented the current administration, from attacking Iran without the permission of Congress. In other words, you just can't go ahead and attack Iran like you've done with Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, certainly going over there. Having stories, after all, we went into Afghanistan because we were going to get Osama bin Laden, and then we never tried to get him. He escaped into Pakistan. We didn't follow him in. We didn't try to get him. We didn't try to knock out Al-Qaeda. We just changed the reason we were over there. We were going to go after those weapons of mass destruction. When they weren't there, well, we had to get rid of Saddam Hussein because he was a bad guy. And now we're there to establish democracy in Iraq and throughout the rest of the world. That's what the major thrust of American foreign policy is, bringing democracy to the world. And George Bush has said this repeatedly. And now he wants to go to war with Iran. But Congress actually took that amendment out of the legislation that would have restricted us from going to war with Iran, and now why the president can do that anytime he wants to, and Congress has abrogated their responsibility. And then another very, very disturbing thing was, of course, in the Friday Wall Street Journal, they talked about how the Security Council, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and China, Russia, and China had agreed on very more strict sanctions on Iran, certainly boycotting the use of their banks, depriving them of the ability to get foreign funding for their activities. And, well, when you put sanctions on the country, that is an act of war. I mean, there's no question. When you put sanctions and restrictions on trade for a foreign sovereign nation, this is an act of war, and that's how we were able to get the Japanese to attack the United States back in 1941, where we put sanctions on them to force, where they faced, giving in to everything we wanted or attacking us. They had no alternative. They couldn't buy oil anywhere in the world. The Japanese couldn't in 1941. They had a six-month supply of oil. We forced them to attack. Well, you know, why would the Russia and China go along with, you know, this move towards war with Iran unless Russia and China would just love to fight to the last American soldier in the Middle East? Exactly as Russia certainly allowed us to go to war with Korea back in 1950 because they were quite willing to kill an awful lot of American soldiers there. And so they effectively walked out of the discussion of the United Nations so we could get into that senseless war in Korea that dragged on and on and on, another no-win war, like the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is a no-win war because, after all, we're funding Pakistan, that's funding Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, that's funding the Taliban, that's killing American soldiers in Afghanistan. Doesn't make sense unless you realize it's exactly what happened during Vietnam, where we funded the Soviets, who funded the North Vietnamese, who funded the Viet Cong, who killed American soldiers, and the rice paddies and villages of South Vietnam. We'll be right back. Well, Carl Grunwald, how are you this evening?
Well, good, Dr. Stan. Always good to be on your show.
Well, tell us what your take is on what's happening economically across the country.
Well, things are getting worse and worse, as you know, and of course you never hear anything like that in the media, but things are winding down awful fast. Chrysler's going to lay off thousands of workers and, you know, give them a buyout, and you know, the Fed's printing bales of money and pallets of it, and of course we can get into those details, but it's going down very fast, but the media's covering it up and saying, no, we turned the corner, just like they're always saying, so.
Well, I think it's really what's so interesting is what's happening to the subprime lending market. And for our listeners out there, subprime lending is when you make loans to people to buy a house that should not be, really wouldn't qualify. It used to be you had to have, you know, 10% down at least to buy a house, sometimes 20%. You know, then, of course, 5%, at least you have to have some money down. Subprime people are not only getting a house for nothing down, now they have to do is just move in, maybe not even pay anything on the principal, just pay the interest on the loan. And these are people who cannot afford the loan, and sometimes they've given them these adjustable rate mortgages, the so-called ARMs, and then, of course, 3 years down the line, they have to renegotiate it, and many times the house will have less worth than that actually paid for it. They just walk away from it. They leave the lending companies stuck with that house, and more of the lending companies are really going down. I understand, what, 26 of these subprime lenders have already gone bankrupt? Have you heard that, Cal?
No, I haven't, but it doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, I mean, some of the biggest ones in the country, some of the biggest subprime lenders have actually gone bankrupt. And Jimmy Rogers, who's certainly a very, very well-known pundit, has said that this is going to create an awful lot of pain, an awful lot of hurt, an awful lot of people are going to be hurt before this thing's over. And he's moving out of the country. He's put his mansion in New York up for sale, $15 million mansion, and he's moving to Europe.
A lot of people are thinking about the same thing, you know, getting out of this country, Canada, or Europe or overseas somewhere.
Okay, fine. Well, basically, the market seems to be holding up. So why is the market holding up if there really are all of these problems?
Well, again, as you know, it's totally artificial and manipulated. They'll keep that up, you know, until the very last dog is hung, and then they'll let it drop. So it's completely artificial, just like every one of the commodities and markets are totally manipulated. So that's the name of the game today. It's deceit and manipulation.
And I think that's really so vitally important. Hold that thought for a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening is Cal Grunwald, and Cal does support Radio Liberty. And Radio Liberty, of course, I think Cal does a good job, you know, as far as providing advice to people who are interested in various things from a financial matter. And we were just simply talking about why is the stock market doing as well as it is? Why has it recovered from that massive drop it had recently? If so many of our major corporations are simply moving out of the country, or so many of our major corporations are laying off people, our jobs are leaving, our manufacturers leaving, well, of course, these companies can make pretty good profits overseas. But the big thing is that the stock market is no longer a reflection of a free market at all. There's something called the plunge protecting team. The plunge protection team has, of course, the head of the SEC and the head of the Federal Reserve and somebody from the Treasury and somebody from the Commodity Board, and they get in and they simply manipulate the market. It's illegal, but there was an executive order during the Reagan administration that gave them permission to do that, to prevent panic, to keep the market from tumbling, and they're doing that right now because they're playing games with our mind, with our reality, and things can't be so bad if the market's up, and all you have to really do is manipulate the Dow Jones. That's all most people look at anyway. And so that's what, 40, is that 30 or 40 stocks, Cal?
I think it's 30.
All right, fine. So they just manipulate those stocks. They buy them, and they can manipulate the commodities. It's all manipulated by this working group on financial matters. And unfortunately, the average American honestly believes that we have a free market out there, which we do not. So where do we go from here now? Certainly the subprime housing market is in real trouble. People are looping, even in certain places of the country, the houses are being repossessed. A few places, the prices are still going up, and nowhere near as rapidly as they have in the past. But as these adjustable rate mortgages, more and more of them are going to have to be renegotiated at the end of 2 or 3 years, why, I think more and more people are going to lose their homes. So where do you see the economy going, Cal?
Well, I guess I focus on what the dollar is doing and what the Fed is doing with the dollar.
Okay, fine. Well, what is the dollar doing and what's the Fed doing with the dollar?
I ran across a very interesting article. Have you ever heard of the Idaho Observer?
Yes, uh-huh.
I'm going to be advertising in that paper now, but that's neither here nor there. The editor sent me a couple sample copies, and I don't know if I've ever said this on the air, but our government is shipping in billions and billions of dollars of counterfeit money into Iraq, to bribe people there to go along with our regime. And I found an article in the the February 19th edition of the Idaho Observer. It says, the title is "Billions of Palleted Dollars Disappear in Iraq."
Well, I mean, there's somewhere between $8 and $12 billion. Nobody knows where they went. And they say, "Oh shucks, we're just so incompetent." $8 or $12 billion on pallets, just loaded down with freshly printed $100 bills. They all disappeared. Oh shucks. Yeah. Well, we'll look into that. Maybe we can find it, or maybe somebody will turn it in. Or how could you lose $8 to $12 billion?
Well, the thing is, it weighed 363 tons. It was on pallet. I mean, you don't sweep that under the rug. It says this came out of Reuters, February 7th. It says the U.S. Federal Reserve sent record payouts of more than $4 billion in cash to Baghdad on giant pallets aboard military planes shortly before the United States gave control back to the Iraqis, lawmakers said on Tuesday. It says bills weighing a total of 363 tons were loaded onto military aircraft in the largest cash shipment ever made by the Federal Reserve, said Representative Henry Waxman, chairman of the House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Quote, who in their right mind would send 363 tons of cash into a war zone? That's exactly what our government did. And on December 12, 2003, they sent in $1.5 billion. Were shipped in, and then it was June 22nd in 2004, another $1.6 billion were shipped in, but as you said, nobody can find it at all. So when they're doing that kind of thing, and as we mentioned before, last quarter of last year, the Fed printed $320 billion worth of cash and infused it into the world economy. This year they're planning, at least $1.3 trillion over the year's period of time, of just cash and credit. And what's it going to do to the value of the dollar? So we don't have any good jobs anymore. They're all gone. They've already left, and the ones that are still here are dying. And, you got General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, last bastions of manufacturing in this country. So when there are no jobs, then what do? You just print money and give it to people. And they spend it. That's the next step. And, of course, Home Depot's got a program just like that. So the Fed is giving Home Depot millions and millions of dollars to give on home, home improvement loans, things like this, and there's no interest. There's no interest for 6 months or a year. They're just giving money away so that people can spend money on their homes or whatever else they want to do to keep the economy going.
Well, people have to pay that back down the line?
Well, they do, but again, it's to get the free money, easy money in people's hands. At no risk. It's just like you were talking about those interest-only loans and home mortgages. Well, fine, people can walk into a house. They don't have to have a down payment. Everything's easy, but payback, then it's not so easy, and if you don't pay, you're out in the street. But they don't tell you that. They just dangle the nice carrot in front of your face that you'll never get it. You'll starve to death, seek after it.
And I think what people have to understand is that you can create prosperity by simply expanding the money supply. But eventually, of course, you destroy the value of the currency. T- Today, the inflation rate in Zimbabwe, that used to be Rhodesia, is 1,700% a year. And so that basically, you know, you've got over 100% inflation every single week, about 150% inflation a week, so that they recently gave the nurses there a 300% increase in their salaries, and the nurses said, we can't live on it, and they went out on strike. Yeah, so, you know, what you do is destroy the value of the currency, you destroy the stability of the society, and we're headed in exactly the same way, and our leaders are not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. And that is really what's so frightening. Obviously, they want to destroy the value of our currency, disrupt our economy, and then, of course, I believe, take us into the North American Union, the Amero, and then, of course, into this one world government. It has always been their dream, and of course, they don't need America now, because, of course, they now have their world army, their world financial system, their world police force, their world parliament, their world courts. Everything is in place for the world government. So, you know, we are in the terminal stages as they move to destroy the value of the currency, and with that, the value of the savings of literally every American who's foolish enough to keep the value of what he's worked his life for in our the currency of the realm.
Well, this is one of the things that I have the most difficulty with when I talk to people, is to try to communicate to them that our, you know, the dollar, our dollar is being eroded away through inflation because they have X number of dollars in the bank or the stock market, wherever it is, and the numbers look the same, but the purchasing power is drastically reduced. They don't see that, and they don't understand it.
And because the people, you know, they believe the government figures, inflation is only 2%. Well, look at the price of gasoline, of course, you know, why gasoline's going up at this time. You know, doesn't make any sense because the price of oil really is down to about $55, $56 a barrel. Here in California, just today I saw, you know, a regular gasoline, just regular gasoline at $3.20. You know, and of course, by the time you got to ethyl, it was about $3.40 or $3.50. But, you know, look at what's happened to the price of health care. Look at what's happening to the price of so much of the food that we're buying today. It's all going through the roof. Yet the government insists that, you know, we only have a 2% inflation. Inflation is really related not to the rising prices, it's related to what the volume of the money is. And according to, they've quit printing the M3 because they don't want people to know what's really happening. But Bob Chapman says that the M3 is about 11% at the present time, which means that your dollars are losing 11% of their value every year at the present time. And if you have your money in insurance policies or annuities or in CDs, and you may be getting 5 or 6% on your CDs, which means you're only losing, you know, 5 or 6% of the value of your money by the time you get it back. And Cal, people don't understand these principles. Mm. They're as old as time, but of course you have to have money in something that has value, because when you have a fiat money currency, they are always destroyed by the irresponsibility of government.
Well, that's right, and that's the very point that I continue to try to make when I talk to people, that you have to have tangibles in your hand that have value and will always have value, and that's where gold and silver come in, and of course you've got food and other medical supplies, things like that. They'll always have value, and they'll be tremendously valuable later on when the common person can't get them. But try to convince somebody to, you know, get out of the government's glue trap and pay the interest and pay the penalty, pay the interest and pay the taxes, and the government's got already 50 cents on your dollar right there, and so most people are so intimidated they just stay where they are, and then they'll eventually lose it all.
Well, I think this is the great tragedy, and it's happened time and time again throughout history. We have a little pamphlet called The History of Money, and of course this should be a wonderful book by Ed Griffin, The Creature of Jekyll Island, that explains this, and it should explain it very well. But what's happening is not new. It's happened 100 times, hundreds of times down throughout history. Every time a nation goes on a fiat money system, eventually those people who are trapped in it end up becoming impoverished. Well, Cal, certainly with the instability of the dollar, was really, to me, is so surprising that gold and silver now, for some months now, have been sort of locked into a very narrow trading range. Why?
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
The average individual is motivated by two things, greed and fear. Greed, because you think you're going to make a killing, and fear, when you fear you're not going to. And you can't be emotionally involved in anything you do at this time. People are going to have to think through very carefully what they do, make their own decisions, think outside the box. Do not listen to most of the political pundits. Remember, I am not a financial advisor. I'm an amateur historian. But at least I've seen these cycles over and over again. And Cal is saying that, you know, people are really not that interested in buying right now because gold seems to be locked into a box there around $650 and silver around $13. And yet we're up considerably over the last couple of years, aren't we, Cal?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was going to make a comment when you were talking about actual inflation numbers. And it's a chart I did in my paper on actual inflation numbers over the last 3 years. And without going into a lot of detail, I checked the commodity charts, and I took eight different commodities that people use on a day-to-day basis. And I wanted to see what the actual inflation numbers were from 2003 to 2006. So I looked on the international futures charts and picked the numbers for May of 2003 to May of 2006. And then I did a percent increase of eight different commodities divided by three, and it came up with 35.5% per year actual increase in those commodities. If you want to call it inflation, you can. But as you mentioned, you know, go to the gas pump. 3-4 years ago, gas was $1.25 a gallon. It's now $3.20 out there. You know, it's $2.70 here. It's just in Wisconsin. You know, the food, the lumber, you know, everything is just going up. And so, you know, when you get a 5% increase in your salary or something, you just lost, you know, you just went down 30%. I mean, that's the reality of it all. So people don't realize that or see it, but those are some actual numbers that are kind of startling in the chart that I prepared. So.
Is this chart available to offer that to people?
Oh yeah, it's in my paper. I've written it's now 33 pages. The paper is called "Gold and How to Avoid the Scams in the Coin Industry," and there's a lot more in there. Except, you know, just talking about the scams, it's just some of the government scams are in there, and that's one of them for sure. And that actual inflation chart is in my paper. So I'd be glad to. Send a copy of that to anybody who asked it, or I'll email it. I have it in electronic form too. So if you'd like that, you can go to my website, which is www.goldandsilverexchange.info. That's gold and, write out the word and, silverexchange.info. And there's a contact page you can fill out, and I'll be glad to email the paper to you. If you want a hard copy, the hard copy right now has other documents that are not in my email form, the emergency banking order, article.
That was back in 1933, speaking of.
Yes. Of course, when Roosevelt confiscated gold in 1933, he did some very strange things that aren't really strange if you know the government. But he declared a two-day banking holiday and then closed all the banks. And then he told all the bankers across the country, go in and open everybody's safety deposit box and take whatever you want out of there. That's what he did, and that's what the banks are going to do again. So one of the things I tell people, never have anything valuable in a safety deposit box, because it's going to be somebody else's valuables, not yours, when they close the bank door.
All right, fine. What's your telephone number, Cal?
It's 414-234-8267.
Well, give it one more time.
Yes, 414-234-8267.
Okay, fine. I think these are very, very uncertain times. I'm very, very worried that an awful lot of people are going to be very badly hurt before this is over, especially those people who are in debt. And, of course, there's the old saying, you know, the debtor is subservient to the lender, and you've borrowed money from somebody, and what happens if something comes along? You can't make your payments. This is the technique that they've used over and over. This is, you go back and you study what happened after the Congress refused to renew the charter for the First Bank of the United States in 1811. Well, first of all, of course, we ended up with the War of 1812 for no reason at all, other than to punish the American people for not renewing the charter of the First Bank of the United States. Why? Because it was controlled by the European bankers. And then they took us into just a downward spiral. They cut off all availability of funds. People, of course, owed money on their farms or industries, their factories, and certainly on their homes, and they lost them all. It's happened over and over again in the intervening years. Well, this is Dr. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly if you're out there and you have a question or comment for Cal, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I believe we're living in really very, very dangerous times economically. And it's interesting, if you read the financial pages as I do on a regular basis, you find that more and more of the economists are coming out and saying they're concerned. Now, a few years ago, all the economists were very, very optimistic. But although probably a majority of the financial advisors are still optimistic, there are a growing number of them who are really very concerned about the financial implications of what's going on now. Because America is the largest debtor nation in the world. We're having to borrow between $3.5 and $4 billion every single day. Just, of course, to pay the debts of this country. And then, of course, we either have to stop spending. And can you imagine that we would really stop spending? Or we're going to have, of course, increase taxes. And you increase taxes while you plunge the nation into a depression, because of course people aren't going to invest under those circumstances. And so, and of course, if they were to lower the interest rates to try to stimulate the economy, why, people would begin pulling their money out of the country. If they raise the interest rates, they'll slow down the economy. So they're basically in a lose-lose situation. But what's really so interesting is the European banks are beginning to raise their interest rates. The Japanese banks are beginning to raise their interest rates, and we're going to have to raise our interest rates as well. Otherwise, people would rather go to Europe and invest than invest in the United States, especially since there's some question about the, you know, about the stability of the dollar, whereas at least the euro seems to be much less prone to losing its value through inflation than the American dollar. So, you know, I would really believe that if they raise the interest rates, is really going to have a profound impact on our economy. What are your thoughts on that, Cal?
Well, that's very true. We're not even afloat now with the interest rates we have. If they go up, you know, anything that is currently going on is going to stop. So you're right, exactly.
And of course, in certain places in the country, why, there still is quite a bit of sales. You know, the economy is fairly good. I know in South Carolina, where my daughter lives, why, the economy is really doing pretty well, and there's quite a bit of building going on. But in the adjacent states, why, things are beginning to slow down, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Cal Grunwald. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got Ray calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. I had a question for Cal. How far along, when do you think they'll start building this NAFTA superhighway? And I know they're going to try to build it. They're going to try to build it up to Canada, right? You think what will happen is the Chinese will use, they'll ship their goods up from Mexico. The Chinese will probably use that highway.
Well, I've heard they're already acquiring land. Have you heard anything, Dr. Stan?
Yeah, I think they're going to really start to actually building it this year sometime, Ray.
Yeah.
In other words, they're in the process. They've got everything through. They've got the plans through. They're beginning to, of course, acquire the land. And so they'll be starting to build it probably this year. They're not going to get very far. It'll take a number of years to do it.
Yeah,
it's going to be very expensive. But what this is all about is simply globalism. It's all about closing down American industries, bringing in a product so cheaply that our factories just cannot compete, and of course our factories will close down, and we will no longer be an industrial or manufacturing nation. This is an attack on certainly the economy of the United States, and an effort to redistribute the wealth of this country. As people continue buying foreign goods, our deficit our foreign deficit goes up. This year our foreign deficit is over 800 800, I think it's about 840 or $850 billion, almost $1 trillion of more we're spending than we're taking in. And no country in the world has ever spent itself into prosperity. Anything else, Ray?
I believe that very soon we'll be taken over by Red China. I'm really fearful because I see they bought out a lot of American companies.
Right.
And it's frightening.
Well, it ought to be frightening. Basically, we have a syllabus where it's called Financial Tsunami, and I did it about a year ago. What was really so interesting is 25% of American industry has now been purchased by foreign companies, and something like Westinghouse. I mean, what could be, is it Westinghouse?
Yeah.
What could be more, of course, American than that, except now it's a Japanese company. And so many of our major companies now are owned by either European or Asiatic countries, and the profits are not going to remain here. They're going to be sent out of this country. Anything else, Ray?
Oh, that's about it.
Okay. God bless. Yep. Don't fret. Things are going to have to get a lot worse before they
don't
get
Don't worry.
Talk to you later. Okay, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Cal Grunwald, Cal, one more time, why don't you get your web page out and your telephone number if people would like to get in touch with you.
Yes, the website is www.goldandsilverexchange.info. That's goldandsilverexchange.info. My phone number is 414-234-8267. That's 414-234-8267. I've had some pretty interesting conversations since I've been on the air last.
Tell us a little bit about them.
I'd like
then.
To share, just because, you know, that's what I do. I talk to people and, you know, what's going on with them.
So tell us what's going on with the people you're talking to.
Particularly with, you know, with the gold and silver market, I ran into somebody who bought, what was it, a bag and a half of silver from, a big kind of silver dealer in the country. No names here, but then he also bought 1,000 American Eagles, and he's heard me on the radio a number of times asking the next logical question is, when the dollar fails, and if you're buying silver for upside potential or profit potential, what do you get in return, you know, for your silver when it hits $50 or $75 an ounce, and who do you sell it to? So he asked this one big dealer those questions, and the dealer was just stymied. What are you going to sell your silver to, and what are you going to turn it into if there's no currency? Well, the dealer said, well, you'll turn your silver into another kind of silver. So that was that answer. And the second answer was, well, you can sell it to industry because it's an industrial metal. Well, there won't be any industry. If the dollars collapse, there won't be any industry in this country. It'll be a black market, but there won't be any industry. So you can't sell your silver to industry because the industry won't exist. And the third thing he said was, well, you can exchange your silver for somebody who has gold. Well, in the chaos that's going to be all around us at that point, with the collapse of the currency and, you know, mayhem and bedlam, no one's going to be wanting 55 or 100 pounds of silver in exchange for, you know, 5 ounces of gold. So these people that are silver pundits and praising the glories of upside potential on silver, they have a hard time answering the logical questions of what happens when the currency collapses and what are you going to do with the mountain of silver in your closet or your living room. So I'm not trying to belittle these people or make fun of them. That's not the point. But because some of them, I know they mean well, but they don't think things through logically to what's going to happen when the currency does collapse, because it's a very real question that everybody has. Another thing too is that the rare coin market. I said this years ago. I'm not selling like a prophet, nor do I think I am one, but I just use a lot of common sense, looking at history just like you do. When times really get bad, the collector or the antique market or the rare coin market is going to dry up, And then it's just going to be the ounces of gold or silver you have in your hand. And again, about a month ago, now maybe 3 weeks ago, I got a fax from one of my big suppliers, wholesalers, and I was just kind of shocked, but not really, because the mint state, high mint state coins of 64, 65, 66s, the market over the last 9 months has dropped for those coins 28% across the board. 28% in the rare coin market has gone down.
So basically, an MS65 run over and above the price of just the cost of the gold in it?
Well, the average, I would say the average company is getting probably anywhere from $4,500 to $5,000 for an MS65 $20 Liberty, and of course, gold is $654 an ounce. So there you have your markup or your premium, and that's why these companies sell these high mint state coins, because there's huge money in it. But the buyer will never get the money out of it unless gold reaches that level. But those coins have dropped dramatically. Those coins, but the circulated, the lower grades, they've maintained their value and they're very strong. So that was kind of an eye opener to me, and it just. Something to tell people, to caution them. You know, you don't want to get into these very rare coins, because you'll never get your money out of it. Secondly, and they're promising you the sky as far as upside potential, but just the opposite is happening.
Well, I think there are an awful lot of sharks out there in the water, and I think you have to be very, very careful when you're purchasing or in this field. Are you running into any people who are having to actually just sell their coins because of financial problems? Because what's really always puzzled me is why they haven't run out of bags of $1,000 bags or $500 bags or 90% silver. I would have thought they would have run out of them long ago. Are some people actually putting their coins back into the market?
Yes, people do that. Of course, silver has gone up, $4.30 an ounce. It was that for years to, a little over $13 to $14 right now. So that's a 250 to 300% increase. Some people do, but the people who speculate with bags of silver, they buy 100, 200, 300 bags at a time. You know, these are the big money people that play the game. But most of the common people, they don't buy and sell. But again, it's the idea that people are not really tuned in to buying gold and silver in this country, simply because the prices are so manipulated. Media doesn't talk about it. You know, they aren't saying, well, look at our currency. You know, it's lost 60 to 65% of its value in the last 4 years, so why don't you get into something tangible? You'll never hear that in the media. You know, just the contrary. Every Wall Street is still king. They're still telling everybody you invest, and, the sky's the limit, and you're gonna get rich. And unfortunately, the masses still believe that.
Well, I think the amazing thing is how they have step-by-step taken this away from a value based currency. In fact, at the time the Federal Reserve Board was created back in 1913, it was stipulated that the dollar would be backed by gold. And then, of course, when President Roosevelt nationalized gold in 1933, the dollar was still backed by gold. In other words, maybe Americans couldn't own it, but the dollar still had a gold backing. And it really wasn't until 1971, August 15th, 1951, when Nixon took the world off of the gold standard. I can remember his speech. He said, "This is only temporarily. We're only going to temporarily close the gold window so that nobody can buy gold from us any longer, but it's only a temporary thing." Well, here we are, 27 years later, and of course, they've never opened the gold window again. But it only took, from 1971 with the pressure from the Vietnam War to 1980 before we had, 18% interest rates. We had runaway inflation. They had to get we had 18% inflation. They had to get about up to 21-22% interest rates to, stop the inflation, or that they would have lost the dollar at that time. And then, of course, instead of doing the right thing and trying to cut back on production of money, they've massively increased the amount of money in circulation since then. And it's been great. It's created an artificial prosperity. And look at all the great new homes and all the cheap things there are out there to buy, and how we funnel that money into China and into India and into Brazil and Argentina and countries all throughout the world who industrialize the world. But it's all been done with a fiat money system, with monopoly money that had nothing behind it. And sooner or later, the day of reckoning is coming. And I suspect it's going to be sooner rather than later, because there is no instance in all history when a nation or an economy has been based upon a fiat money, where eventually the politicians have not simply been irresponsible and allowed runaway inflation, which has destroyed the currency, as it's doing exactly in Zimbabwe today, and it's only a matter of time before they do it here. And as long as we continue fighting wars that we cannot afford, as long as they don't make the American people, you know, pay for that, we can do it on borrowed money here in California. Where we're going out, we've already borrowed $40 billion. We're going to borrow another $40 billion next year, and maybe another 40 after that. We're going to keep spending all this money, and nobody ever asks, when's the money going to be paid back? Who's lending the money? Where's the money going to come from to pay back the loans? And you know, Cal, the most amazing thing, the American people, the people of California, have never asked. It's all free money. Isn't it wonderful? And all the prosperity it's going to bring.
Well, that's right. And a lot of the new construction, also you mentioned South Carolina, a lot of that new construction is, it's federal money. It's free money. They're just infusing into the government, into the economy, so that people keep working. But they just printed or issued credit. There's nothing backing it. So it's pretty destructive.
Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Coeur d'Alene. And once again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm well. Thank you, Dr. Stan. How are you?
No complaints at all.
Excellent. God bless you.
Do you have a question for our guest?
I do. Cal, I think I might be a little confused. So I wanted to ask you, you were talking about how people who were wanting to invest in silver might be sorely displeased by the performance when, if ever, to collapse. What then should the average Joe with a family do if gold is out of their means? What then?
Yeah, I'm not. I didn't say that you'd be disappointed with the performance, because the performance will be there. I mean, and that's common knowledge that silver will really outperform gold as far as the multiplier. But what I'm saying, what I'm cautioning people is to get heavily into silver, so you have hundreds of pounds of it in your house. Now the people that don't have much, you don't have much means, then get some, get a quarter bag or get a half bag of silver. That's still 14 to 28 pounds of silver. That's still a lot, and you can survive for a long time on that. So there's nothing wrong with that. I'm advocating that.
Oh,
it's just,
okay.
It's just that when people are talked into buying silver for investment purposes, because it's got such a tremendously high potential above gold, which it does, they're saying the silver multiplier is anywhere from 10 to 15 times, whereas gold is only like 3 to 7 times. Well, that's fine, and I have no argument with that at all. And we'll see what happens to both of them in the future, but they're probably going to be right. But the point is, what are you going to do with 2,000-4,000 ounces of silver when the dollar collapses? You're not going to make any money, because there's no currency to turn it into.
That's
my point.
Okay. Well, let me ask this: do you think, I've heard reports that there has become what's known as peak silver, that the production and the demand and the availability of silver is such that now there can never, ever be enough silver mined for the demand of industry, and also if there's also an equal demand for currency, it will never be able to be supplied.
Well, that's true.
That is true?
I don't have any problem with that. What I'm saying is that industry is going to die in this country, so there will be no demand. There won't be any demand at all. Then just people are going to buy it for currency. if you
would there still not? Wouldn't there still be an industry for money changers? I guess for purchasing
I guess that's not production. I mean, I'm talking about manufacturing. You know, when you make a product out of raw material.
Right.
You know, we're a service country right now. You know, so there. You know, when the gold and silver supply dries up, then I won't have a job either. But until then, I will.
Gotcha.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
No, thank you for allowing me to ask those questions.
Okay, God bless. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go to another Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. One slight comment or correction.
Hold that thought here, because we're going to have to, you just hang on, we're going to have to let our listeners know our guest this evening has been Cal Grunwald. Cal, one more time, your telephone number.
414-234-8267.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this hour. Mike, go right ahead.
What you were just saying a few minutes ago about free money, I have a slight disagreement. Money is free for the banks.
That's right.
Right?
Not for the public, right? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's
free. The Fed gives it to the banks, you know, and then the... You know, that doesn't cost them anything. They're in bed with the government. They are the government. And then the Fed or the banks lend it to people, and then there's the payback.
Yeah, in the fractional reserve system, it literally is free, right?
Basically, of course, you only have to keep a fraction of the money you have lent out in reserves is the way it works. And so, you know, then you could lend out 10 times what you actually have in reserves, and then, of course, there's no money there. There's no... Bills, it's simply a paper entry, but you can actually charge interest on that non-existent money. That's the scheme. That's the scam of the fractional reserve system.
Yeah, well, I guess some of us are more equal than others. Huh?
Right. Anything else?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, God bless. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners, Cal?
Well, again, I just kind of sound like a broken record, but. I'm just trying to get through to people so that they'll understand that they really have to take control of their wealth and have it in their possession. You know, possession is 9/10 of the law. I keep making that point over and over again because it is so basic and it's so simple, and there's nothing complicated about it. But unfortunately, our system that the government is erected here is, you know, like I said, it's a fiat money system, and the government has, through deceit and lies and manipulating the media, convinced everybody that the system is as good as gold, but it's not. It's an illusion.
And as we often say, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king.
That's right.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Cal Grunwald, and I hope you enjoy our conversations as we try to point out to people that the stability of a nation is dependent upon the stability of the currency. And, of course, those people who really understand what's going on today know very well that, of course, of all of the various means of cheating the working men, none has ever been more effective than the lie, than the delusion of paper money, or as Daniel Webster said, of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none is more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. And ladies and gentlemen, you have paper money, but look on the back of your dollar bill. What's that occult emblem doing there? That, of course, shows you the spiritual force behind our monetary system. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening, of course, has been Cal Grunwald, and we've been talking about the monetary system. People need to understand what's going on. If you'd like more information, let me suggest several books. One of them would be The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. Another would be the book The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Anthony Sutton. And one of my third favorite is Fiat Money Inflation in France. Now, I have a little pamphlet. It's called The History of Money, and another talk we've given called Financial Tsunami, the talk, of course, and then the syllabus. And if you're interested in more information, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, Chris, I think it's so important that people begin to prepare for the difficult financial times that do lie ahead. And, of course, our contention is that there are people in key positions of our government who have no loyalty to this nation. Their loyalty is to this internationalist dream, the New World Order, the one world religion. And there is a spiritual component to everything that is going on in the world today, whether it be our financial system, whether it be our educational system, whether it would be the current wars that we're involved in the Middle East, or what I fear is going to be a war with Iran. Now, there's some people who say, and these are very, very, very smart people, they say, no, everything going on in the Middle East today, bringing all of our forces to bear, two aircraft carrier units, as well as the Bunker Hill, I believe that's the name of it, strike group, which has 8 ships in it, and I don't know, brigade or something of special forces, Marines and SEALs. They're just there, you know, to frighten the Iranians and to make concessions. What doesn't make any sense is the Iranians are not doing what's logical. Because if I was the Iranians, I would say, look, what do you want? We'll give it to you. The last thing we want is to go to war with the United States. And what are the Iranians saying? Boy, you better not get out of line. Why, if you do anything foolish, why, there are going to be terrible repercussions for you. Could you imagine? I mean, saying that to the United States, the mightiest military power in the world, what is Ahmadinejad doing? Running all over the world, you know, and saying there was no Holocaust, we're going to wipe Iran off the face of the earth, you know, Europe, Western civilizations all going to be destroyed. There are people in Iran today who are doing everything to generate a war. It doesn't make sense logically. So there must be another explanation, and of course it's our contention there are powerful spiritual forces working behind the scenes. You'll certainly want to read my February newsletter. It will be available probably in a week or so, week to 10 days. You go to our website, read our newsletters, and let me suggest that you get our material on the occult hierarchy. You'll find that at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And read our articles on the occult hierarchy, or the spiritual hierarchy that rules the world. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you should, but there really are powerful forces that work behind the scenes, and many of these, of course, are a transition force to the other dimension. And there is increasing emphasis today in our television about people who can talk to spirits or ghosts or the mediums or fortune tellers or diviners or people who can bridge that gap between this dimension and the other dimension. The tragedy is most Americans don't understand that there are demonic forces in the world today that are intent upon taking hold possession of the souls of men. And this is one of the phenomena that's sweeping this country. It's called The Secret. You'll certainly want to see our new talk, which will be available in a week or two, called Forbidden Secret, and the 4 tapes that we're putting together on The Secret. This is a program to introduce people all across America to the mysteries that have been passed down through the centuries, to the Rosicrucian concepts that we can manipulate the world with our minds. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And our guest this evening for this hour is Mr. Stephen Hyatt, and he's the editor of a book called A Game as Old as Empire, The Secret World of Economic Hitmen and the Web of Global Corruption. And, of course, this is a sequel to John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Now, who is John Perkins and what's the significance of his work? Well, if you go to the Internet and you go to Google and you type in State Department Gov Misinformation, State Department Gov Misinformation, Google that in, it'll take you to the State Department section that deals with misinformation. They will tell you all the things that you're not supposed to believe. Now, you're not supposed to believe there's anything to these stories that the government had advanced knowledge of 911. You are not to believe that there's anything wrong with depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is really good for you. You're not to believe, of course, any of the conspiracy theories out there, and specifically, you're not to believe anything John Perkins says, because John Perkins, who wrote the book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, just is not at all reliable. Well, of course, everything that the State Department says is misinformation. I happen to believe is true, and I suspect that if you read the things that they have up there, you realize that this is propaganda. They are frightened that the American people are going to find out the truth about what John Perkins wrote and about what Mr. Hyatt is going to be talking about tonight, a game as old as empire. George Bush has reiterated over and over again, we do not have an empire. The United States doesn't have an empire, but if that's true, why do we have troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world today? Why do we have over 700 foreign bases while we're closing down our military facilities at home? We have all these bases, and why is it that so much of the world lives in poverty when we live so well? Well, Mr. Hyatt, certainly this must have been an exciting project for you to edit this book and get all the writers together in your book, A Game as Old as Empire. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you happened to edit this book.
Well, I was called by the publishers, Barrett Kohler, to work with John Perkins on this book. And we had a number of discussions about where we would find economic hitmen, people with similar kinds of careers to that of John Perkins, who would be willing to come forward. He had some leads, people that he knew. We cast around. We talked to a number of people. It was kind of an exciting thing. It was very different from anything I had done before. Usually when you want to get an author to write a chapter in an anthology like this, a collection, you don't have to communicate with them via third parties. You learn their names, you know. In this case, we talked to a number of people. The first kind of breakthrough came when I was reading actually the London Review of Books, and it was very interesting. A man named John Christensen was writing about the offshore banking network and his own experiences on the Isle of Jersey off Britain's Channel coast.
The Isle of Man, that we'll be back here.
The Isle of Man is one of the other banking havens, yes.
All right, fine. Well, you go right ahead. So anyway, got Mr. Christensen. He is one of the authors of the book.
That's right.
He writes a chapter.
Yes, and I realized, you know, this guy's an economic hitman. He played a role very similar to that of John Perkins. You know, he was recruited to work for an offshore bank. He was an advisor to the tax haven of the Isle of Jersey. very cushy lifestyle. It's very seductive, right? John Perkins talks about that, how hard it is to get out. It becomes a way of life, if you will. But he did. He looked at what he knew was going on as a result of the offshore banking network and how it sucks money out of the third world and away from average people in the first world as well. And he knew that he had to leave that. He suggested some other people we started working with, Greg Muted at Platform, a London-based NGO that looks long and hard at the oil multinationals around the world. We talked to a number of people. John suggested we get in touch with Steve Berkman, who was an inside investigator for the World Bank. So we talked with him, and he agreed to participate based on his many years of experience in Africa and Latin America. There were some who got away. We talked, for example, to someone who worked in the accounting office of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. And after a while, that person decided for reasons of health not to participate.
You mean reasons of health because he wasn't healthy or because he was afraid he might be eliminated, as have been so many people?
It would be easy to do, wouldn't it, given the kind of situation that's in Baghdad? And I don't know the person's, I don't even know it was him or her, but given the situation there, I don't know the circumstances exactly, but you can see why somebody might make that determination. We talked to a mercenary who was also working in Iraq, who had helped overthrow a couple of governments, and he was interested to tell his story, but on the other hand, he still wanted to be a mercenary, so he decided not to participate. So we had some interesting people we tried to work with, and eventually we assembled a group of people who were insiders like John Perkins, investigators and investigative journalists, people who had expertise in particular areas that they were writing about, to basically broaden out the story of John Perkins, who worked for indirectly for the National Security Agency in the U.S., and we're bringing together stories that illuminate the same
thing. Hold that thought. Hold that thought.
I will do that.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Steve Hyatt, and he has edited a book called A Game as Old as Empire. And this has to do with how the world really runs, not the way you're told how it runs, but how, of course, you have a corporatocracy. You have corporations that really supersede government, control government, work in concert with the security agencies, the CIA, and, of course, their program is to keep the countries of the world in debt, to the point where the countries, these poor nations throughout the world, are all well over $3 trillion. I mean, the largest single item in any of their budgets is paying back the interest on their debt. And, of course, we send economic hitman over there to get their leaders to go ahead and borrow all sorts of money, which, of course, puts the government in debt. And, of course, the government then will extract money from the poor people. And, of course, what happens is so much of the money that goes into these poor nations goes into the hands of rich people in poor nations. And just as foreign aid takes money from poor people in rich nations and gives it to rich people in poor nations, this is exactly what they're doing here. And they use bribery, and they use extortion, and they lose rigged elections, and they use murder, and they use every form of corruption to control the politicians and the military and the administration in third world nations so that they will maintain control over their populace. And so the people will be permanently impoverished, and of course that wealth actually comes to the first world nations, and so you have half the world living on an average salary of about $2 a day, and then you have you and I living in the lap of luxury. Would that be a fairly good summary, Stephen?
That's a pretty good summary. I think that's highly accurate. One of the routes into this, it's obviously, as you've indicated, it's a multifaceted story. One of the routes into it is, and actually one of the things that we found has changed since John Perkins was active as an economic hitman in the 1970s and early 80s, is the growing centrality of corruption in the world economic system, compared with even a generation ago. One example he gave was the general who ran Nigeria in the late 90s, a guy named General Sani Abacha. General Abacha had a standing order with the Central Bank of Nigeria to wire transfer $15 million every single day to his offshore, in this case, Swiss bank account. $15 million every single day. Now, you might say, well, you know, guy is very corrupt, right? That's certainly true. On the other hand, if you're a banker at Credit Suisse, for example, you're not thinking about, does this man make $15 million every day? Nigerians must be a very generous nation to pay its president that kind of money. No, they knew where the money was coming from. It was being stolen, and they were happy to pocket it. Similar things go around the world of these banks. Our subsidiaries usually in offshore havens, the Cayman Islands, Jersey we mentioned, the Isle of Man. There are a number of them, about 70, I think. And some are actually onshore, offshore figure of speech. Switzerland, Luxembourg, also offshore banking havens. But largely they're controlled through large banks in New York and London for the most part, with subsidiaries in these places. Or just reading about the dictator of Tajikistan, an up-and-coming oil exporter. All the oil revenues that country gets flow to an offshore account that only the guy who runs that country can access. They don't go into the public treasury. They go into his personally controlled slush fund, whether it's to benefit him personally or to keep him in power, whatever it might be. Again, the bank, I don't know which one it is in this particular case, but the bank or banks taking this money ask no questions whatsoever. So they are taking money that's stolen, money from drug lords, money embezzled. It goes on and on.
Well, of course, you talk about Mobutu over there in Zaire,
yes.
Who really has really just raped that country for many, many years, but the full knowledge of the American corporations that were working there.
That's right. In fact, I believe it was the World Bank or IMF, I believe, sent a German banker to Zaire at the time to investigate. They'd been reported, and he quickly wired them and said, don't give this guy any more money. He's stealing it all. He was ignored. apparently, Mobutu was too useful in terms of Cold War politics in dominating Congo and in making sure that multinationals got what they wanted there. They kept him in power, even though he stole upwards of, I believe, $10 billion, which then is left as a debt for the people of that country to repay, even though they never saw a dime of it.
And that's really the tragedy. What this whole thing is all about is getting the third world countries into so much debt that the government will not have enough money to maintain the infrastructure of the country. In fact, in many instances, these economic hitmen encourage the government to sell off its natural resources, or the things it owns, sell off its roads, sell off its hydroelectric plant, sell off its electric generating plant, sell off its water. And, of course, what happens to the money? Why, it goes into the hands of the bureaucrats, and the people are left even worse off than they were before, and that's pretty bad. And of course, is the point that Mr. Hyatt and his writers make, is that if you have, you know, a ruler who really is altruistic and he wants to do the right thing by the people, they'll have him killed. I mean, there's just no question. They send in the jackals and they have him killed. That's sort of hard for the average American to believe that, because we're the good guys, we wouldn't do anything like that. Would we?
Well, would we? There's a long history of U.S. direct and indirect intervention in the Third World and elsewhere. Countries like Italy, Australia also have felt the hand of the nudge of the United States in terms of making sure that the right people are in office and the wrong people are kept out. So it's been quite a ruthless operation. Sometimes hidden, sometimes not. Remember the elected president of Chile in the early 70s, Allende, was overthrown, and at the time there was a good deal of discussion about the participation of the U.S. in fomenting that coup. We mentioned the Congo. Mobutu took over from a murdered nationalist leader named Lumumba in the early 60s.
Patrice Lumumba, right?
Yes, and his crime was that he basically wanted the vast resources of the Congo to help develop prosperity for the people of the Congo rather than, in this case, Belgium and the former colonial power in the United States. And they wanted somebody who would be basically their stooge.
And I think this is the point that they really bring out so well. When the colonialism of the First World Nations ended following the Second World War, well, these countries, the First World Nations, Belgium, France, the United States, Germany, Great Britain, withdrew from all of these nations. But they created this whole program of really indentured servitude to debt as a means of continuing to control the Third World Nations. The only trouble was that the Americans were really much more efficient at it, with a vast network and with a vast banking facilities at their disposal, all this money that was created out of nothing, and using, of course, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the International Lending Institution, the Agency for International Development, and certainly Export-Import Bank. They were able actually to then get these countries to begin to borrow money, and that's really the function of the economic hitman, isn't it, Stephen, to get countries to borrow money?
That's one of them. That's that's the kind of role that John Perkins personally played, and it's been duplicated in some other different ways. One of our authors, Ellen Augustine, investigated the case of the Philippines, which was a kind of a key case worth spending some time on, because it was the first country, sort of a guinea pig for these development loans. Back in the early 70s, the dictator Marcos was threatened by civil unrest. He quickly became unpopular after he had earlier won elections in the 60s. And at the time the Vietnam War was going on, the U.S. was quite concerned about where the Philippines was going to go. They devised a plan through the World Bank to get the Philippines to open its economy and to take on huge loans to supposedly modernize. That was what they were told. This is the route to prosperity, to modernity, to become a more advanced country. They would build export processing zones in which the Philippines government would supply all the infrastructure, the utilities. They would set up, power plants and water plants and so forth. Multinationals would come in. They would be exempt from local labor laws, which weren't very strict anyway. They would be exempt from taxes. And supposedly through this, they would draw industry to the Philippines, and they would become vastly prosperous. It didn't happen. In fact, the companies quickly found even more willing and cheaper places to operate. They left, leaving the Philippines holding the bag in terms of the money that they have borrowed to set up these places. Meanwhile, a number of other local companies were driven out of business by opening the economy to foreign competition when they weren't really ready to compete on that level.
And as you point out, of course, how in country after country, our agricultural products, which are subsidized very heavily in the United States, were flooded into these other nations, under the auspices of free trade. And in country after country, we destroyed their agricultural base because, of course, free trade can't compete with subsidized products.
Well, that's right. The motto of the World Bank, the IMF, the U.S. Treasury, insofar as they talk about development for the third world, has really been free trade. You've got to get on the bandwagon. You've got to join the World Trade Organization. You've got to open your economy. Somehow they never really practice that themselves. We have a number of examples of that. The Philippines, again, at the same time the Philippines was opening its economy, the United States and the European Union slammed tariffs on 32 different categories of exports that are the kinds of things the Philippines actually exported. So the door was shutting on the Philippines just as the Philippines was opening itself up to penetration by other multinationals. We had another example from Ghana, where you can imagine, and this is a very crazy story actually, local farmers in Ghana are being driven out of business. It turns out that the European Union subsidizes in an immense manner their farmers, as we know, and so it's cheaper actually for people in Ghana to buy frozen chicken parts shipped from the Netherlands than it is to buy locally grown chickens. Devastating to the local economy, puts people out of work. Obviously, if there were really, you know, free trade, this wouldn't be happening, but again, it's free trade, and it's only one way.
And there are really instance after instance now where this has happened, and certainly we know this has happened in Mexico. One of the reasons why we have so many Mexican immigrants floating into America is because we flooded their country with the cheap corn, subsidized corn, and their farmers couldn't compete with our subsidized products, and now they had no means of making a living, and so they came north there. I mean, they were really driven off their own farms by this whole process of free trade, but it wasn't free trade, because we could not compete, you know, and export corn cheaper than they could grow it, except for massive subsidies from the American government to the corn farmers, and then, of course, then they were able to, you know, dump that into third world countries, and then there are no longer any corn farmers in Mexico, and this happens all throughout the world, hasn't it really, Stephen?
Yeah, you get very perverse effects. For example, in Peru, a little farther south, again, the government was forced by the World Bank conditionalities based on the fact that they were heavily in debt to open their agricultural markets to U.S. corn. What happened, of course, was, as you were saying, that U.S. products come flooding in. Local farmers are driven out of the market. In the case of Peru, what happened was that many of them turned to growing coca for cocaine production. So again, a very, very, you know, pernicious effect of so-called free trade.
What is that law of unintended consequences
exactly
that we talk about?
Yes, exactly so.
Well, of course, the one reason why this book was written is because John Perkins had been criticized, saying, well, you're the only one who ever talks about this process, this idea of economic hitmen. Are there any other people out there that have done what you did? Is there any way you can verify that what you're saying is true? This book is to introduce you to other people who did exactly what Mr. Perkins did, who worked very, very profitably for the government and for these secret agencies to actually enslave the people of the third world. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Stephen Hyatt. His book is A Game as Old as Empire. Well, let's go into some of the people that you list in the book and perhaps their stories. And you have probably, what, about 10 or 12 people that you...
That's right.
And of course, each one of them has a... this is one of the things that really fascinated me. The rods of debt relief. One of the things on the State Department page on misinformation, you ought to go there and read it. They say, well, John Perkins said, we were trying to get people into debt, nations throughout the world into debt. Why, the United States was pushing debt relief. So you've got a whole chapter on that, Chapter 11, written by James S. Henry. Why don't you tell us the story of the program, for American program for debt relief? Because we're from America, and we want to help you poor, impoverished people who are so heavily in debt that you just really don't have any money for education or for medical care or for roads. So America is now going to offer you debt relief. What's that all about?
Well, you know, there's been agitation for debt relief for a number of years now. There's a group, Jubilee, which was hoping to slash very heavily third world debt in time for the millennium. And after, you know, a worldwide campaign, both in the advanced countries, Europe, North America, and in the third world, there's enough attention that, you know, some kind of, you know, crumb had to be thrown out. Some kind of PR campaign had to be staged because they just gotten so much attention to the pernicious effects, the exploitative effects of all this debt. What Jim Henry, who's a, both an investigative journalist and an economist, has shown is that the amount of debt relief that was announced at the G8 summit a couple of years ago, $40 billion, turns out to kind of vanish as you start to look at it. And by the time you get down to, okay, there's this condition and then there's that one, and when you will you really get it, it's worth about $16 billion. Now, you have to set that against the $3 trillion that third world countries owe, paying at least $375 billion every year in debt service on that debt.
As you thought, I think that's such an important $375 billion from these poor and impoverished nations to service their debt, and they're offering them $16 billion really in debt.
Right,
for them.
Yeah, even if it had been the entire $40 billion that was announced, you know, for some of the poorest countries, yeah, it would help, and I you know, it's I guess it's good that they did that, but you have to also look at what the countries had to go through to qualify for this program. It was not a, let's look at who's really heavily indebted and where these programs aren't working, let's slash that debt. No, they had to go through all kinds of programs to slash their budgets, particularly slash their development budgets, education, social services, and so forth, to qualify. They put themselves basically in an economic straitjacket in order to meet the standards of the IMF and World Bank to get this amount of debt relief. So you get countries like Ghana, where the rate of education, that is the percentage of children at various ages actually in school, is falling. It's falling because the countries had to slash education spending, so schools are fewer teachers, and families are forced to pull their kids out in order to earn whatever, you know, small amounts they can, just because they're so pressured. Again, that's the kind of effect these kinds of programs have. So a lot more needs to be done about debt relief. You might be saying, well, you know, these people did contract the debt. And one of the points that Jim Henry makes is that, in fact, the U.S. had in the 19th century quite a record of debt relief on its own. Various states and territories went bankrupt in the 19th century, wrote off their debts. We financed our railroads in part through bonds sold to Europeans that then companies were rendered bankrupt in the people were never paid off. So we did quite a bit of that ourselves. He points out there's actually a legal doctrine going back to the 19th century called the Doctrine of Dubious Debt, which states that if somebody, say, on behalf of a company or a country, contracts debt in a fraudulent manner, we were talking about Mobutu, who's got loans and he stole all the money, you know, that then the company or the country is not bound to repay that debt. It's partly a responsibility of the lender in collusion with the contractor. So there's actually legal precedent for doing this.
Hold on a second. We're going to be back in just a moment with Stephen Hyatt. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Mr. Stephen Hyatt, his book, A Game as Old as Empire. And this is really a sequel to the book we've reviewed before and had a number of interviews with Mr. John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I found Mr. Perkins to be very, very believable. I believe his story, because this is exactly what happens. And it's simply so much of what is described has been described by Mr. Joe Stiglitz. Professor Joe Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner, economist who certainly worked for a time for the World Bank, and of course he wrote a book going into what the International Monetary Fund was doing. When he left the World Bank, he wrote an appendage or maybe another book saying the World Bank was doing exactly the same thing and working in concert with these corrupt concepts. And when the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank would come in to help a country, and they would start providing all this money and advice, and by the time they got done, the country was far worse off than it was before. How could you pour billions of dollars into a country and have it worse off than they were before? And I think it's just these techniques that Mr. Hyatt is describing. Of course, they go in, they bribe everybody in the country, they give them the money, and it never gets to the people. And if it does get to the projects really are not going to benefit the average individual. They're going to benefit certain specific industries that are going to come in that are usually tied one way or another to the world corporatocracy. That's a new word that's been coined, but I think it's such a good way to express it. There is this brotherhood of corporations that rule the world. Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Hyatt?
I think that's a pretty good way of looking at it. Certainly there's an elite. The writer Jeff Foe calls them the Party of Davos, the corporate elites, government elites who meet each year at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. In exchange, I suppose, war stories and strategies. They come from multinational corporations. They come from elite institutions, governments, and so forth. A few select media people. So they really call shots. And one of the things that we see as we look around these multilateral and world organizations. One of the things that's really changed, I think, again, since John Perkins was active as an economic hitman in the 70s, is the increased role of organizations like NAFTA, like the World Trade Organization.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Mr. Hyatt. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Mr. Stephen Hyatt. His book, A Game as Old as Empire. We think this is a great book. We are going to carry the book, and we hope maybe we can put together a four-tape set as we did with Mr. John Perkins, which is a four-tape set of interviews with Mr. Perkins, and we are hoping to interview other people who are, of course, have written for this book. Are they available for interviews, some of the other writers?
Yes, they are, as a matter of fact. I think you can probably interview all of them if you like.
All right, fine. Well, of course, we'll want to get you on again. Because we do actually 5 hours of talk radio a day, so we have three different audiences, and then different audiences on the weekend. We have four audiences. I want them all to hear your remarks, but we'd like to get the other people on as well. Because the more people we have who have actually been part of this system and are willing to come forward and really to risk their lives and their future and their families to tell the people the truth. And did you find that some people were really afraid to come forward?
You know, I was thinking as you were talking about the way in which loans were flooding into countries like Indonesia, where John Perkins first worked. We had talked actually to a guy, I won't say his name, he hasn't really agreed to come forward yet, but I worked with him for a number of months. He was actually the man who was in charge of building the power plants that John Perkins forecast, changed the forecast, exaggerated the forecast to get the loans for in the first place. And he went over there. He was connected with kind of construction projects through U.S. and Canadian companies. And he found himself in the middle of the situation where billions of dollars have been contracted for these plants. Okay, you're going to build power plants in Indonesia. Where are you going to put them? Well, he was driving around the countryside with agents of the government, and you could only put them, as it turned out, in irrational places because those irrational places turned out to be owned by the ruling Suharto family. And it turned out, well, what would you want to use as a fuel for a power plant? Well, Indonesia has oil, it has gas. You would use oil or gas, right? No, they wanted to use coal because they owned mines in Australia that they wanted to exploit, and that would make the Suharto family more money. On and on it went. Everything was rigged so that whatever you did, you enriched some member of the Suharto family or their cronies in an additional ways. We worked with this guy for a while, and he nearly had a breakdown trying to come to grips with this. Apparently, it had been an extremely traumatic time for him. It nearly destroyed his family. You know, he would send me things, you know, at night. You know, he'd been working on them. We never quite got to the point where he was ready to submit a manuscript. We batted back things back and forth. But it illustrated just how difficult it is many times for people to come forward and deal with, you know, what they've been a part of.
And, of course, we, the United States government, had overthrown Sukarno and put in Suharto, this corrupt family, and we kept them in office for a number of years. Eventually, we got rid of them. But we put them in power. We utilized them. They carried out our policies. And it was simply a means of colonialism, only you would have a nominal, you know, a government there headed by a corrupt regime that was kept in power by the United States. Now, if they would not do what they were supposed to, then, of course, we would send in professional assassins. And they had list about, 15 or more people, world leaders, who were actually killed by the jackals, who were actually exterminated in one way or the other, or overthrown. Of course, they rigged the elections. These people would stop at nothing to control these governments. That must have been so difficult for people to believe.
Long story. It's interesting that these situations come up. There's a crisis in a country. There's a coup. We read about, was the U.S. involved? Oh, there are official denials. But there are other reports that say, yeah, in some way they were. And then we go on, and things die down in that country. And then we go on, and we kind of, it starts up again somewhere else, and it's like suddenly it's the first time each time. We fail, I think, to connect the dots to see the pattern of what's been going on and really take in why is it that the United States needs to be involved in rigging elections and bringing people to power in so many countries, overthrowing so many elected leaders. What is that about? What does that say about maybe getting a little far from the principles of government of and by and for the people?
It's all about control, and that is, of course, the message of this book, a game as old as empire. But this is a new means of having an empire. You don't necessarily occupy the country, although you may have some troops there, but you use the only old domestic troops. You use the own rulers there in the country, but you control them. You control them with bribes and with threats with rigged elections and with sex, and whatever you have to use, you use that to control them. And if they get out of line, why, there's either a revolution, or they lose the election, or there's civil unrest, or you send in the jackals and kill them. That seems to be the modus operandi, and as it comes through in the book. Well, why don't you tell us about some of the other people that write and give their first-hand opinions of what they actually did, what they actually witnessed.
Well, I was telling you a bit about John Christensen, who had been an offshore banker, again, with a career parallel to that of John Perkins. And I'll tell you something about some of the kind of the central findings of these people, which I think kind of illuminate the different aspects of the book and the aspects of empire. One of the points that John Christensen makes is that one-third of all the wealth in the world is now held in these offshore accounts, offshore banking havens. And the reason is very clear, that it allows those people with wealth, multinational corporations, to evade taxes. What this means, and the implication is very clear, is that obviously third world countries don't have the tax base that they should to have their wealthy elites contribute to the country's development. It means something for us as well, because it's not limited just to people, the wealthy of Argentina or Nigeria sending their money to these havens. It's true of North Americans and Europeans as well. And what it means is that you and I and our listeners have to pay more than we otherwise would in taxes to make up the difference. Or it means that when we need things to happen, a better education system, health care, many other things, the money isn't there because, again, the tax base has been eroded by the flight of this money to these offshore banking havens, again, largely controlled by key financial center banks in New York and London and other financial centers. So it's extremely important a development that, again, is different from when John Perkins first set out.
Well, are the banks in the Isle of Man and the Isle of Jersey, are these then controlled by American and European banks?
That's right. Those in the UK offshore industry are largely controlled by London banks, but there are subsidiaries of U.S. Ones as well, and they make a killing, frankly, doing this.
Sydney, aren't there banking laws, of course, that the domestic banks are required to let our own government know about people's holdings in their foreign banks, or is that more or less ignored for the chosen few?
Well, there are some laws. They're weak. They're not enforced very much. One of the tactics of particularly the Republican administration, the current one, but the Clintons weren't that different, is that the amount of money appropriated for enforcement, which as you can imagine would be a painstaking and difficult task, is very small. There are very few people, compared with the scope of the problem, very few people working on it. So there are some rules. They're not enforced a lot. It does come up sometimes. There are embarrassments that happen as when the dictator Sani Abacha was overthrown, or actually died in office. The Congo then tried to get some of that money back and were partially successful, not completely so, in tracking down where he had hidden his cash. So that does happen. One of the things that John Christensen does is now work for something called the Tax Justice Network, which is a worldwide network of people who are campaigning to actually set some rules on these banking havens and open them up to public scrutiny.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now, what sort of response have you gotten to this book? How long has it been out?
Well, we've just come out in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Right, so that's really been out very long.
No. This is actually, today is the official publication date. The book has gotten into bookstores a bit ahead of that, but we can celebrate the publication date with my appearing on this program.
Really? I mean, were we one of your first interviews then?
One of the first.
All right, fine. Well, we're flattered that we were able to get you on ahead of all the other people who want to get you on, I'm sure. Now, of course, as you go through so many of the things, one of the things you talk about is BCCI, that sometimes affectionately known as the Bank of Criminals and Congressmen. But what was BCCI? Why was this the fall of this bank so important?
Well, BCCI was a very interesting institution. It was founded in the 70s by I believe he was Kuwaiti, with Pakistani and Gulf interests in charge, set up an offshore banking network. They were officially headquartered in Luxembourg, which is another offshore banking haven, and very quickly became a very useful tool for all kinds of interests. They would take deposits from anybody, gangsters, drug money. They laundered money for Manuel Noriega of Panama, for example. He was a good customer. They also funneled money for the CIA around the world. They were very heavily involved in financing the Mujahideen guerrillas in Afghanistan during the 1980s. And that's where Osama bin Laden comes in.
Well, wasn't that really tied into the CIA?
Yes, it was. The connection is both with the CIA and with Pakistan's counterpart called the ISI, a very powerful organization which was behind the creation of the Taliban in Afghanistan. So BCCI served many many masters in funneling money secretly around the world for various projects, whether it was our CIA, Islamist interests in the Middle East, drug money, stolen money, gangster money. They were into it. And unfortunately, they weren't as good bankers as they were hitmen. And they eventually lost a lot of money. It's a little murky as to how, and probably a lot of it was stolen. They had taken, unfortunately, a lot of deposits from, you know, ordinary people in the Middle East who then lost their money, up to $13 billion. So unfortunate from that angle. But, you know, a very extremely corrupt institution. And, again, it served the interests of so many people who wanted it secret ways to send millions of dollars to fund private armies and conspiracies of all kinds, that it was, you have the U.S., U.K., other countries looked the other way. They didn't want to get too far into it. Eventually, there were, they basically were alive with so many people violating so many laws that there were district attorneys here and government agents there who were after them, that eventually there were some prosecutions, but they were never really definitive. A few people went to jail. Most people did not.
In fact, some of the very, very key people here in the United States were involved in that, and their names escapes me as now at the present time, but I remember one of them should have been prosecuted. He said, oh, he's just too sick to be prosecuted. And of course, the judge said, all right, you don't have to be prosecuted, you're too sick. And the guy just has a great big party that night, you know, after. And it wasn't sick at all. I mean,
I think you may be referring to Clark Clifford, who was a...
It's Clark Clifford, well, the fellow, I'm thinking, his last name started with an A.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, a number of people, both in our Republican and Democratic parties, the Bushes did business with BCCI. Jimmy Carter and Burt Lance did business with BCCI. You know, some people, because they were so well connected, some people, at least initially, may have felt they were dealing with a legitimate organization. But
Robert Altman was the man I'm thinking of.
Yes, I think you're right.
Anyway, of course, there's total corruption at every level of government. And of course, this was really used by NSA. All of these illegal operations were going on, and this was being used to funnel so many of these illegal operations.
That's right.
And then, of course, you know, certainly the tie-in to the Central Intelligence Agency and the relationship between the CIA and the corporatocracy. Do you want to cover on that perhaps a little bit?
Well, there's been, of course, a lot, kind of a revolving door between the CIA and similar kinds of intelligence services. There's not just one. There's the CIA, but there's the DIA, there's the NSA, there's, you know, several others. And the top levels of various kinds of corporations, certainly part of the military-industrial complex. You know, there's some very profitable firms running private armies around the world. We cover that, in fact, in the case of Nigeria, where there's basically private armies protecting Chevron and Shell oil installations in that country. We talk about the basically guerrillas who kidnapped one of those guys, a low-level economic hitman, if you will, a security agent. Again, that's the kind of thing that you get CIA and ex-CIA people involved with. So there's a lot of that going on.
Do you have a website you'd like to get out, anything like that?
Well, as a matter of fact, we do, and it's www.kfuo, GameAsOldAsEmpire.com.
GameAsOldAsEmpire.com. We will be carrying this book. We think it's an important book. If you'd like more information, of course, you can always talk to Mary at our exchange. We'll tell you a little bit later about that. We think it's vitally important that people have first-hand information. And this book has information that you're not going to find elsewhere. And going along certainly with the information Mr. John Perkins has put out, and the fact that the State Department thinks it's so important that they'll have a whole section dealing with misinformation and a whole section with Senator John Perkins and his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Well, John, we've got 3 minutes for you to, pardon me, Stephen, you've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. So you go ahead, and what message would you like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, I think we should maybe make a note of sort of the opposite of economic hitmen, which we also treat at the end of the book, which is that there is also a web of global resistance, just as there's a web of global control and domination, made up of movements of around the country of many different kinds of people, whether they're small farmers, they're oil company workers in Iraq, whether they're small business people, environmental people, all kinds of folks are coming together in their own countries and own ways to network and to resist the control, the exploitation, the domination of empire. One of the things that we look at is the new Iraqi oil law, which is just about to be adopted. It's been pushed very hard on Iraq by the U.S. and the IMF, and will pump out about $200 billion from Iraq over the next 25 years to multinational oil corporations. There's now a campaign against that. It's called Hands Off Iraqi Oil. You can look that up on the web. It's been connected with the demonstrations against the war in Iraq that have been taking place, highlighting what seems to be certainly one of the motivations of that invasion and occupation of Iraq, which is to get hands on what's become an increasingly scarce resource, petroleum. Again, there's now a worldwide resistance movement to point out this and to bring it to light and make sure that that money goes to reconstruct Iraq from all the suffering that those people have gone through under the vicious regime of Saddam and then the sanctions and now the occupation. Vitally needed to rebuild that country.
And I think really this is just the height of hypocrisy to say, oh, we're here to bring you democracy, but we're going to control your oil. We have to do that because you're not smart enough to get out of the ground, and we're just going to take all the profits. And, of course, you could have some menial jobs there working in the oil fields, but we're from the West, and we're here to help you. I mean, this is the greatest war crime of all time. They've lied to the American people about why we're in Iraq, and now they've negotiated these treaties with the people that we appointed to government, and we end up with the oil. We win, you lose. That's the way the game is played. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. I'm looking forward to get you on to a number of our other programs.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening has been Stephen Hyatt. I hope you enjoyed the program. The book is A Game as Old as Empire. Now, this talks about the corporatocracy, this ruling corporate elite that interlocks with the intelligence agencies, the CIA, NSA, and with the military, and the secret organizations within the military, to create a web of subversion throughout the world. And this is why we have troops stationed in 130 different nations. The book, if you'd like to know more about it, why you can call Mary at 1-800-544-8927. We also, of course, have copies of I'm not sure whether we still have Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but we certainly have the four-tape set with Mr. Perkins, which, of course, is very, very revealing. It's called Economic Hitman. So If you'd like more information and would like to donate to our ministry, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. For this book, A Game as Old as Empire, and you have to understand that what most people do not understand, most people think this is all about profit, and it is about profit. But also, in addition to that, there are powerful spiritual forces which are tying this whole thing together, which are intent upon dragging us into World War III. Nothing going on in the Middle East today makes any sense. Why would Russia and China have voted to allow increased sanctions against Iran, who is their ally, and sided with the United States, who is their enemy, against Iran, who is their friend, unless, of course, they want to draw America into a massive war there and fight to the last American soldier? But why would America certainly want to put itself into such a vulnerable position and take a chance on inflaming the entire Islamic world and possibly down the line precipitating World War III? Why would George Bush do that? The American people don't want to go to war. The Iranian people don't want to go to war. The Iraqi people, and if you read my latest news, you'll find that 91% of the Sunnis want America to leave. I mean, 90% of the Sunnis believe the attacks on the American forces are justified. 70% of the Shias want America to leave, and a similar number feel that the attacks on America are justified. We'll have all the statistics from the latest polls over there. So why don't we just leave? Well, of course, some people say we can't leave until we get those contracts signed for the oil. Once we get the contract signed for the oil, then we're going to leave. Well, I wish it were going to be that simple. Nothing makes sense unless you understand that there is an X factor. And that, of course, is what I describe in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and let me recommend that as a source of information. You can actually see the DVD up on the Internet. Just Google in a video, Brotherhood of Darkness, and you can watch it there. But we'll hope, of course, you'll want to get all the detailed information, and so you'll certainly want to talk to Mary at 1-800-544-8927, and she'll make some suggestions of what you may want to do. We do hope that many of you, of course, will want to get a copy of our catalog. If you'd like a free copy, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free newsletter, our January newsletter goes into the Fitzgerald Report, which has been suppressed for 50 years, and tells how they've been suppressing treatments for cancer for 50 years. 1953, the Fitzgerald Report was included in the Congressional Record, and nobody has been able to get a copy since then, until it's being offered free of charge by Radio Liberty. So get the information, understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Understand how this corporatocracy that they speak of interlocks with the Brotherhood of Darkness, the spiritual forces behind it all. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.